Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. You'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalog of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. Well, we will get started on today's episode where we will be talking to one Sonia Bevan. Sonia is an avid dog lover with a Bachelor of Science degree in physiotherapy. This combination led to seeking science-based information on how to teach dogs, and she completed a Diploma of Canine Behaviour, Science and Technology with distinction through the Companion Animals Science Institute. Sonia works as a behaviour consultant in her business, Dog Charming. She has been a university facilitator for vet students in animal behaviour for the past 5 years, and her special interests are fearful and reactive dogs, low stress handling / cooperative care, assistance dogs — she is a mind dog trainer for psychological support dogs — ethics in animal training, separation anxiety — she is a certified separation anxiety trainer — and providing freely available video training tutorials. She believes that dog and animal training is both a science and an art. When based on solid principles of applied behavior analysis, teaching also allows creativity when applied to each unique learner, and fun. Training should be fun. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one Sonia Bevan to the show today, who is patiently waiting by in Perth, Australia. Sonia, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang out with us at Animal Training Academy.
Hello, right back. And thank you so much for having me. As you know, I am stoked to be here. First Australian slang, stoked, for all your American listeners.
Someone told me that they listen to all of their podcasts on 1.5 or 1.75 speed, but when it comes to the Animal Training Academy podcast, they have to slow it back down to normal speed so they can understand what I'm saying. So apologies to everyone that might have to go extra slow today to decipher all that Australian slang. But great to have you here, Sonia. Mutual friends of ours speak very highly of your work, and I've watched some of the aforementioned freely available video training tutorials that you offer online, and have been personally inspired by them and share them regularly with our online community. So I am fangirling / manning out right now to get an opportunity to share your offerings with our audience. So we are very grateful. Sonia, I'm wondering if you could take me and the listeners back to where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training and share with us some stories from this time.
All right. Yeah, I'd love to. And I've written myself some notes so I don't forget, because as I was thinking about this, a lot of things came up and I thought, oh, yeah, that's right. That's what happened. So as you've mentioned, I am a physio, so I've got a science background, and that's an important thing for me, and it's part of my genesis in becoming a dog trainer. And so is Zuri, my Rhodesian Ridgeback. So I waited about 20 years until I felt it was the right time to get a dog. So I had my own physio practice, and then I thought, right, I'm going to go part-time. I didn't want to get a dog while I was full-time and leave it at home, so I was just waiting, and I love dogs so much but I just felt it wasn't fair to get a dog unless I was home more. And then I finally did get little puppy Zuri. And it was really, really important to me to find out, how do I train this dog and how do I communicate with this dog? And I started reading. And one of the first books I read was How to Speak Dog by Stanley Coren. And I had a bit of a chuckle because he's recently written a blog about how to stop your dog barking, which has been a little bit controversial. And I thought, you know, the book on How to Speak Dog was just amazing for me to read. That got me so interested. So I think I might have read a few other books, Don't Shoot the Dog by Karen Pryor and Bonding with Your Dog, I think by Victoria Shade. And I thought, wow, you can teach dolphins this way. You don't have to tell dogs off. I just thought, I want to teach my dog like that. This is amazing. Why would anyone use punishment if this unlocks such communication and relationship with your dog? And then I started going to training classes and getting advice from everywhere, you know, friends and vets and dog clubs and trainers and breeders. And wouldn't you know it, everyone's got a different opinion. And it was really confusing. You know, I remember learning how to use a choker chain because, of course, Reddish and Ridgebacks are big dogs and they're stubborn and they don't learn like other dogs, okay? Just put that in your head. And I got shown how to use it. And, you know, your dog is a little bit scared at first. But, look, if you praise them, they wag their tail straight after. So they forgive you. And I tried it and it worked really, really well on my, I call her a soft dog, just a really sensitive dog. So any sort of punishment would work really well on her. But I noticed I didn't have to use the choker chain much. It was just the jingle of the choker chain and she walked fantastic, didn't pull anymore. But I have this moment where she was walking alongside me and her head was down and her tail was down and she was walking slow, not a spring in her step. And I thought, yeah, I've met my training aim. You're not pulling, you're walking closely by my side, but we're not having fun, are we? And I actually remember looking at her going, this isn't fun, is it? I thought, no, I am not training this way. There's got to be a better way to train. And so that's when I started, there were so many other things, you know, examples of vets sending me to a shock collar selling place when all I was asking for was a good puppy school. And one of the first cards they gave me was to purchase a shock collar. And I thought, no, that's not what I'm looking for. And not using food in dog clubs and not using a clicker in dog clubs, but I couldn't get a clear answer, like why, when I asked for rationales, you know, it was really unclear. And then there was the breeder that told me to do the dominance test on my so many month old puppy. And it's simply put your hands one on top, one on the bottom of her muzzle, so basically forcibly closing your dog's mouth. And if your dog struggles, time how long it is they struggle, and when they stop, that gives you an idea, the indication of the magnitude of their dominance. So a dog that just lets you do it, not very dominant, and a dog that struggles and fights, very dominant, and that'll let you know how strong you need to be. And I actually wrote a blog about that because I tried it, okay, forgive me, Zuri. And she was terrified. And as soon as my hands went on, she was desperately trying to break free. I let go straight away and I thought, this is a load of crap. and so I tried to find some science-based information on all the stuff I'd heard, the science behind being an alpha and being a pack leader. And you know, wow, do wolves really eat first? The alpha wolf really eat first and then the puppies go eat and the subordinates. And does an alpha always walk in front of the pack, you know, because you're supposed to go out of a door first? And would you believe I couldn't actually find it? So there wasn't any research that actually stated these things. And then there was no correlation between how these wolf studies transferred to dogs living at home studies. And I thought, wow, people are making this stuff up. And I wanted to find the good stuff because I thought people need to know the good stuff. I'm going to train to become a dog trainer and behavior person, therefore to spread this stuff, because it was so hard for me to find out all this information. I wanted to make it easier for other people to find out. So I was kind of like wanting to become this dog training evangelist and spread the good news. You don't have to do this stuff, people. It's out there. So I started looking for science-based courses, and it's really hard. So I have a lot of empathy for dog trainers out there trying to find the stuff, because it's not easy, or it's getting easier now, but it I didn't even know what APDT was, you know, so I couldn't even look up and find good trainers, because if you don't know where to look, you've already hit a roadblock. So I contacted trainers and behaviourists to see how they got started, and got lots of information there. And luckily for me, there was a franchise up for sale in my area. I could not believe my luck, because they offer the training and then you buy the franchise and you've got this support. So I thought, great, the gods are on my side. But because I wanted to find out how they ran the business, I wasn't going to buy a business without finding out what sort of training you get and how they run the business, I asked to shadow a trainer, and, you know, they were fine with that. So I went on a few visits with a trainer, and the first one we did was shadowing a puppy home visit. And remember, I didn't know a lot about training. I was starting out new, so I've come really fresh. But I remember the explanation and the pictures shown on how you want your dog to look. And the two comparing pictures were one of a dog with their ears back, their body crouched down, the tail tucked, and it was described as, this is a submissive dog. And then the other one was a dog with their tail up, ears forward, mouth closed and alert. And the caregiver was told, this is how we want your dog to look, the submissive dog, not the dominant dog. And I didn't, you know, it was a lot of spin, because as we would know now, they were appeasement gestures a dog's giving, and we would not want our dog to look like that. So that was a first red flag for me, even though I didn't know these are appeasement behaviors. I thought, that's not right. That dog looks scared to me. And then the puppy was introduced to a collar and lead, just put on, and dropped to the ground immediately on its little belly. I remember it was a little border collie puppy, only about 10 weeks old. And first time it had a collar on, dropped to the ground, didn't want to move. So it was dragged across the floor, because, you know, you need to get them used to it, and they are just trying to have one over you. Then it urinated, then it started shaking, and there was a lot of spin put on it that the dog is just trying to control you. Look at this, the dogs, they do that, they urinate to try and make you, I can't remember the words exactly, but make you do what they want. Stop what you're doing and do what they want. And they're pretty much pretending to be worried. And when it was shaking, it wasn't shaking all the time. So it was explained how they can turn this manipulative behavior on and off. And I wasn't quite believing what I was hearing. This puppy looked really scared. And then it would stop shaking when it was praised, and then it would go back to shaking again. And at the end of the training, the puppy went to its crate and lay down right at the back in the corner of its crate and fell asleep. And I went home, and I remember putting my hands either side of the kitchen sink, and I just burst out crying. And I wasn't sure why I was crying, but I just realized what I'd seen, there was something off about what I'd seen. So I was still interested in getting into this franchise. So I rang them up and said, were they flexible in their techniques? Because I thought, hey, if I could buy this business that's already set up, then maybe I can sneak in these positive reinforcement techniques and not throw something at the dog. And I wasn't told no, but I was told there's no need, because theirs are proven to be the most effective And sneakily, I've checked just to see how that franchise is going. And it's had about five different owners since I looked into buying it. Then, with all my inquiries ringing up behaviorists and dog trainers, I actually had a well-established behaviorist with a PhD offer me a job and mentoring. And I thought, wow, again, all the planets have lined up. How lucky am I? So I shadowed again. And you'll see a common theme here. I research things and I do like to see things firsthand. But once again, the methods didn't sit well with me. And they worked. You know, there was a lot of leash jerking. But I looked further into what the mentorship would involve. And a few of the other people that had done it mentioned that you don't get a lot of input. You hardly ever see him. So I weighed that up and thought, well, that's if I want a mentor, I really want someone who is actually going to teach me, not just put me in charge of a class doing leash popping and not give me any follow-up. So I started looking at courses, and we're really lucky. This was about 10 years ago, I think, maybe 11. And we're so lucky that there's quite a few courses. But like I said, I was not a dog trainer, so I didn't know where to look. So I didn't even know about Karen Pryor stuff, the Karen Pryor Academy then, and things like that. I looked up TAFEs and unis and online courses, and some had a syllabus, some didn't, some had a course outline, some didn't. And I happened upon CASI, which is the Companion Animal Science Institute, and that's where I got my diploma. And I've got to say, I never looked back from there, because that met my science-based aims. As soon as I looked at the course syllabus, I thought, wow, this is laid out. Someone's planned this really well. All my questions were answered immediately, and I could tell that it was going to teach me principles and not recipes, and it has. It was best move I ever made. So all the research I did, all the looking around made me choose a place that I am so happy with. So it got me started, and of course, you know, learning still goes on after. But it was based on, you know, behavior science, and I guess applied behavior analysis is very similar. And when I finished that, I looked for a mentor. And again, mentors were hard to find then in my local area, which I thought would be great. And I ended up through CASI getting recommendations to a mentor in the USA. So I had a distance mentor, and that was so helpful, because putting all this theory into practice, I wanted to run it by someone who had experience. My mentor was Molly Stone. She's in the US, and she headed up the SPCA, I think it was in Wake County, and she was amazing. So notwithstanding the time difference, I'd send her emails. I think sometimes we'd speak through the computer, and 25 years of experience helped me when I had tough cases. So I really feel for people who are looking for mentors, and I think it's a great thing to do. So that is how I ended up being from a physio to a behaviour consultant and dog trainer.
And what do you feel? I've got a couple of questions for you, but I was just curious, because we've had lots of different guests, or lots of different vocations that guests have originated in before ending up in dog training or working with other species, but working with behavior and training. Physio, potentially you're the first physio we've had on the show, I think. So curious to know what someone in your position who's had years of experience as a physio, what you've been able to use from that time in your life to help you be a dog trainer. Is there anything? Does anything come to mind?
Yeah. That science-based background where you know, you need to think critically. You need to find reliable information and research and, you know, text. And also the assessment process. So I follow the same process in assessing dogs that I used to do for assessing people. So there's a format called SOPIA, which is subjective assessment, objective assessment, analysis of that assessment, then planning what you're going to do, then you put an intervention in place, then you evaluate your intervention, and then you reassess and change things if needed. So I thought, this is great. I'm going to use that in my dog training and in my behavior consults. So subjective assessment is you ask the person about the problem and you get all the information you need. Then you do an objective assessment. So that's probably like a baseline in applied behavior analysis. So you actually have to observe the behavior and get mark and asterisk. What is the most important part of this behavior that we are going to measure to see if we're getting any improvement? Then you, so that's your assessment, assessing and asterisking the most important parts. Then you devise a plan. This is the plan of action. Then you do your intervention, so your training plan, as it were, and it would be my physio plan, how I'm going to treat this client or patient. Then you don't just do that, you evaluate. So your asterisk that you put next to something is, what are we measuring to see if we're actually having effect? So we would evaluate that. Is the behavior getting better, staying same, or getting worse, just like in physio? Is the range of movement staying the same, getting better, or getting worse? And if it is, great, we continue or progress. If it isn't, we need to change our plan. And if it's staying the same, we also need to change plan. And then we continually reassess. So it's very planned and structured, but also very helpful in knowing, are we getting the aims that we want? And not randomly, just, I don't like people that, yeah, my dog's getting better. I want to know, how is your dog getting better? Is the barking increased, decreased, or staying the same? And a lot of other times, you know, subjective reports, where barking's a good one, I'll go in somewhere and we'll put a plan in place and then I'll come back and go, oh, my dog's still barking. And I go, okay, so remember we timed the barking or we counted the number of barks. Is your and when your dog barks, is your dog still barking, you know, for half an hour when people are in the house? Oh, no, stops after 5 minutes now. And I go, okay, so yes, you are correct. Your dog is still barking, but that baseline, that asterisk we put in, the time or the number of barks or where the dog barks has changed and is improving. So it's really valuable in that regard. Because people just go, oh, it's not working, my dog's still barking. And then you point out, but look at the parameters that we've changed. And they go, oh, yeah, it is getting better and it encourages them. Because sometimes people don't know what to look for. It's just black and white, barking, not barking. And, yeah. So, great. That's a good question. You can see that got me going, didn't it?
I'm curious. I wrote a blog called I Have a Confession to Make, but since realizing that it's a confession that lots of people have to make, I feel that is a personal opinion. But data collection, yeah, it's not my number one skill. It's important and I want to do it, but I acknowledge that I have many approximations to take to improve upon that specific area of my application. So curious, how do you have a process for data collection? Do you just kind of, can you offer any more thoughts to help the listeners of this show potentially review their own processes and build upon what they're doing?
Let me think. Probably I always try, and on the field it's hard, you know, when you go, I do home visits. So, you know, you go into someone's home and there's so much going on, you've got lots of information to give them. So you want to give them information, you want to assess the dog, you want to give them a plan to go on with, you want to give them time to practice. I guess I ask them their priority so that I'm, you know, because their priorities might be different to mine. and they tell me what their priority is to, you know, either it's usually to decrease a problem behavior, and therefore I go, okay, we want to increase a desired behavior. I will choose one thing to be observing that hopefully I can measure, and that's easy for me to measure because it's hard when you're doing so many things. So like barking was one. I might look at, okay, I can't count how many barks, we can't record how many barks and go back and count. So I will look at my watch and let them see me look at my watch and I'll go, okay, it started barking at this time. Let's see how long. First time your dog's met me, let's see how long your dog goes for. And then, you know, I get them involved, go, okay, your dog stopped. Is this usual? Yep. And then that's a simple thing. All right, put these strategies in place. You can see what I've done with your dog. I've made the introduction as positive as we can. Hopefully your dog will remember me. Let's see if the barking is the same or stops sooner or, heaven forbid, goes on longer the next time I come. Then we'll know we're doing something right. And then we'll know that, you know, first impressions matter. Your dog does remember me. And that happens so many times. Just putting what we know into practice, the second visit, I, you know, normally do get a reduction in time. And that's something they go, wow. But, of course, they wouldn't notice if I didn't point it out what we're doing, because then I come to the dog usually does still bark at me and they get disappointed. Oh, look, still barking and retreating. I go, just hang on. Let's just see. And then stops, go, wow, look at that. Your dog was barking the whole hour last time, 15 minutes. And 15 minutes is a long time for barking, but compared to 2 hours on a first visit, it's a huge improvement, you know, percentage-wise. So just picking one thing that's easy, and that was an example of time, and letting your client know what you're measuring and then remeasure it the next time.
Celebrating those approximations of your clients or letting them or helping them, guiding them to see the same approximations that you're seeing with all of your knowledge and experience.
Yeah.
So you called that acronym SOPEA. Is that right? Is S-O-A-P-E-A?
SOPEA. S-O-A-P-I-E-R.
Your second piece of Australian acronym slang today.
Yeah.
Hey, so these experiences you had, you didn't know where to look, but you went looking. You found learning opportunities. You quickly realised via one of the things you mentioned was the actual behaviour of Zuri on his walks. He was doing what you wanted, but you could sense that it was not fun for either of you. So this really encouraged you to start creating some content and sharing what you were doing and what you were learning and some of the work with your clients via the free videos that you put out. I know that I feel confident that a lot of the listeners resonate with that feeling that you got at that stage. Like, I want to share this with everyone. I want to go out and tell everyone. So, but you've been making videos and you've been sharing your work and sharing your journey and sharing information for how long now? When did you start doing that?
Probably 2011, I think. When I
for 9 years, that's a good solid chunk of time. Obviously, there's reinforcement in doing that for you. I'm curious to learn through that time, and I really like this concept, and maybe you see things differently, but I'm looking at it just admiring the show what you're doing. Just show what you're doing. Just do good training and put it out there, like, and people can see that. So I really like the idea of you creating this free video series, doing it for so long. I'm curious what you've learned over that 9 year period, and is the way that you look at and the messaging that you want to put out in 2020 the same as 2011? Has it shifted? What have you learned during that period?
Okay. What have I learned? With the videos, I wanted to put out videos. And I like doing it with Zuri with stuff she hasn't learned. So my tutorials, a lot of them, I tried not to edit out the hiccups because I used to get a bit frustrated when I'd watch some really great videos and I'd go and do it with Zuri and it wasn't as smooth and it wasn't as easy. And I had to do a lot of problem solving. And I found I learned a lot from the problem solving. And I thought, well, I might as well put that problem solving in there and show what happens when it doesn't go as smoothly, you know. And when you're learning, we're not as good at raising criteria in gradual stages and reading dog body language. And it, and I thought about it and thought, do I really want to put videos out there that show me doing training that shows my mistakes? And I thought, well, you know, it's helped me when people problem solve. So, yeah, I thought, suck it up and do it. And if you get criticism, you know, that, oh, that was terrible training, which, you know, you maybe want to get by people going, oh, you know, clicked at the wrong time, or, you know, didn't set up the environment well enough, which are, you know, all things that happen in training and then you quickly change it. I thought, no, for newbies who know absolutely nothing, to actually make a mistake or have training falter and slow down and then show how you fixed it might be really valuable. Because, you know, how many times do we train a dog to do something one way and then the next dog we have to do it a different way because they don't follow the same rules? So, yeah, it and doing that helped me plan, because I needed to plan videos and know what I'm going to do in advance. And it also taught me that people appreciate you showing that you're not perfect, because I don't actually have many bad comments on my videos, which is great. You know, I don't get, haven't got a lot of criticism, which is one of the fears when you show people that you're not perfect. The fear is that that's what they're going to focus on. So I was happily buoyed by that fact. Did that answer your question? I kind of thought I went on a tangent then, but
yeah, and I'm curious. I know that feeling of wanting to share all of this information with everyone is, like I said, in my personal opinion, my belief is shared by many people of the podcast audience. And that enthusiasm isn't always met with the same level of enthusiasm by people that you maybe think it would be beneficial for. And so on that note as well, how, and I'm hoping that this question is making sense for you. How have your thoughts changed about how you kind of take that enthusiasm and share information?
Ah, yeah. Okay. You know, I wanted to share that with everyone. I wanted to tell everyone how great positive reinforcement is. Why would you want to train any other way? Absolutely everyone, I wanted to know this. And now I still want that, but I will spend my time trying to disseminate it to those, I think, that are looking, and not to those that are going to push back as much. So if I get pushback, I will just take a step back and agree to disagree and not try and find all those research articles that I used to about shock collars and you know, frantically go looking and have this file full of stuff that I can send people so they can see that it's backed up by stuff. Can't you see that this is good? And you know, to put it, you know, real blunt, Norway is bad. And I mean, it's not good and bad. Nothing is black and white. There are shades of grey. Yeah, I feel I want to use my energy to speak to people that are receptive in you know, receptive in so many ways, even if it's just a little spark of interest. I want to meet them where they are and not bombard, you know. So even now, you know, I sometimes wonder how I will be perceived, because I go into houses where they're using choker collars and shock collars, and I battled with, well, am I still going to help these people if they're still going to use this? And I've come around to going case-by-case basis, of course, but I don't hammer them, because I know that they're using it because they desperately need to get a problem fixed. There is a reason they're doing that. So I will tell them, I will make note and tell them, I would not recommend that. and here is why. And I would respectfully ask, you know, whether we could refrain from using that while I am training. But I won't argue with them and insist that either you ditch that or I'm not going to help, because I understand there are reasons behind it. So, you know, I've gone from battling and grappling with that and maybe not, you know, turning away from people who are seeking information, whether it's other trainers or clients, to actually letting them know my stance, trying to help, and then if we meet a roadblock, only then would I back away and say, probably you need to find your information somewhere else if they're not receptive. So I can serve my energy to spreading it where it's well received, and I'm learning to walk away and not engaged excessively when it's not well received.
Yeah, I call it opportunity costs, because if you invest your energy into someone who's not wanting, might be one situation you might find yourself in. They don't actually want to hear your information, or they are not ready to receive your information, whatever that is. You could be helping someone who is ready and who does want to receive your information. So that resonates with me, and I'm curious to learn even more. And
you're a curious fellow.
That is like the biggest compliment you can get. I thank Steve White for my curiosity. He taught me in one conversation, he taught me the importance of curiosity. Steve, if you're listening to this, thank you. But that situation where you go into someone's house and they've got a choke chain or a electric shock collar or some kind of aversive tool, and you've shared something really valuable, I think, for the listeners of this show and for me, you've immediately identified that there is a reason that you're there, and there is a reason that that tool is there, is because there's a problem here for these owners, for these clients, and they want to fix it. At that point, I feel is a point that a lot of the audience find really challenging, to see that, to be there, to have your heart start racing, your palms start getting sweaty, and then to be effective. Can you offer anything else about not just how you process that now, but your journey to get to where you are, to be able to be an effective coach and trainer for these clients?
Yeah. Well, look, you know, I am still growing in that area, and that's the communication with clients, I think, and with other people when you're trying to get a message across. I'm asking for tips myself. Whether I can give other people tips on that, because my heart still, when I hear about what people are using in conversation, and oftentimes, you know, I'm just thinking of a conversation I had yesterday over the phone, and talking away, and I spend quite a bit of time talking to clients on the phone. I'm quite happy to talk to them before they sign up, and if they get a feel that they want to continue with me, I think that's good for them. And it was a simple aggression case, and we're talking away, and it only began 2 months ago, and we're trying to figure out they're trying to figure out why and give me all these reasons, because the dogs come on heat. And then if I hadn't talked to them for so long, I wouldn't realise that the dog had a shock collar on, and that had been in the last 2 months. And so in my head, I'm connecting the dots and going, oh, maybe, you know, side effect of aggression, but I don't want to make the owner, you know, okay, guilt maybe. I don't want to make people feel guilty for using these things, because they're using them for a reason. They might have to get rid of their dog if the neighbours keep complaining. So in order to keep the dog they love so much, they need this shock collar. They're ringing me up for a different problem, you know. So I have to hone my skills. And like I said, I'm still trying to figure this out. How am I going to work with someone where I really think getting rid of the device would help, but we don't have a relationship yet? So there you go. I've answered my own question. Getting in there and getting a relationship with someone, empathizing with them, understanding them, trying to work with them, And then maybe once we have that relationship, they will be more receptive to my request to try a technique that differs from using what I would not use. There you go. Thank you, Ryan. I've done relationship.
My job time. Is done. No.
Yes.
You say you don't want to make people feel guilty. Do you? We had Ken Ramirez on a live web class last week, and he shared with us, and then I'm paraphrasing Ken here, so Ken, I'm sorry if I butcher this, but he shared to us when situations are really challenging and he wants to hide his facial expressions because he's a little bit shocked. He might actually put his now it's because I've got my hand in front of my face. He might put his hand in front of his face, or he even bites on the back, on a little bit of skin on the back of one of his fingers to kind of mask. Because he doesn't want to make those people feel guilty.
I know, and that reminds me, I've been trying to practice my poker face because I've got a very expressive face. And I've actually asked some of my clients, once we've developed a relationship, something's come up, and inside I'm going, whoa. And I ask them, you know, straight away, if we've got a good enough relationship, I'll ask them, did my face change then when you said that? Because I want feedback, because I think that must have shown. I'm trying desperately not to let it show, but I think something snuck out then. I grimaced, or I might have flinched or something. Yeah.
And then I get from what you're saying, you see relationships, but I've something that I'm taking away personally. And if I am, I'm going to say that I share enough similarities with the audience of this show to say that they're taking this away as well, is that you don't want to make them feel guilty. You said earlier that you walk in appreciating that those tools are there because they have a problem that needs, something that they're labeling as a problem that needs to be solved, or and that might be so much as they need something, they want to keep their dogs because their neighbours are complaining and the council's been on their case.
Yeah.
So for me, the word that I would use to describe your awareness of those things is compassion. Have you thought about yourself as a compassionate person before? Is compassion an important aspect of this, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm really pleased that you said that, because that is something that I would like to get across, and I hope my clients and other trainers that I deal with can sense that. And even the name of my business, Dog Charming, I want it to reflect compassion and empathy, and so definitely.
Well, I would have liked to have seen your poker face when you asked about puppy school and someone told you to go to a shock collar selling place. And compare it to now. But hey, there is something else we wanted to talk about in this episode, and we've been going for about 45 minutes now. So to make sure that we get to that, just quickly before we do, what does 2020 look like for you? What are you up to at the moment? How's the pandemic?
Okay. What's it looking like? Well, it's been an interesting year. I was employed on a casual basis by the university here, which is our main vet school. And I loved that gig. I was just so fortunate. And they just recently introduced a low stress handling module, which I thought, how amazing for undergraduate vet students to be learning this stuff. With COVID, the university was not shut down but couldn't do it on campus anymore, so that put a spanner in the wheels. And I used to love going. I would take my dog there and demonstrate, so we couldn't do that. So it's been a year of taking a course that was very hands-on and demonstrative to taking it online and learning a whole new platform, because they don't use Zoom and things like that. They've got their own platform that they use for teaching students. So it was a huge learning curve, but nothing is ever wasted. Whether they pick up their casual employees again, you know, with COVID, who knows, because universities are really suffering. So I'm just sitting tight on that and seeing what's going to happen. Will that position continue to be available? And I hope it will. But video consults, who knew? I was already doing video consults with a lot of separation anxiety. But people used to be hesitant. And now, because they've been forced into the situation with their work to learn how to use video software, everyone knows Zoom, people are more easily persuaded to do video consults. So I've had an increase in uptake, not just for separation anxiety, but for some other cases. So I'm really stoked. I even got a referral from Canada, my first overseas client, which was, boom, I thought, yeah, that's great. And down south, you know, in WA and over east. So it's actually been really wonderful. And that's a skill for trainers to learn, because I love to demonstrate. So I normally demonstrate with a dog and then pass it over to the person and watch, and then, you know, very quickly reassess. And not being able to test the dog first and see what the dog can do was a bit of a challenge for me. But yeah, it's actually, you don't realize what you can do until you do it. So that's been, yeah.
You're a big international entrepreneur.
Yeah, that's
hey, I'm celebrating that approximation with you. That's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, it is. If you get, you know, it's a baby steps, and that's, you know, I tell people just be patient, and these things often come to you. If you put it out there, then grab these opportunities like this podcast. I've never been on a podcast before. So I'm quite nervous, but almost turned it down, but then thought, no, if these things come to you, embrace them if you can, and you know it's another learning experience.
Can I ask you to be even braver? What made you nervous about it? And I ask because you talked about earlier sharing your videos online about making mistakes, and that's an area where I am invulnerable. That's a space that I acknowledge as a vulnerable space and needing courage to enter into. But you said yes to this podcast, and you said yes to sharing your mistakes. What makes you nervous, and what helps you get over that?
Well, in reference to being nervous about coming on a podcast, obviously I listen to this podcast and I have seen the people that you've had on this podcast, and you've had some big guns on this podcast, and you've had some very interesting people. You know, my gurus, Kim Ramirez and Susan Friedman and so many others. I won't name them all because I'll probably miss people out, but, you know, really and interesting. So I guess my fear was, oh, my goodness, I'm going to be boring compared to these people. And there's no way I can compare with the storytelling, you know. So it's that thing of comparing yourself to others, which I don't, you know, I believe we shouldn't. I think everyone's got a story. So, you know, what I think I didn't transfer to myself, I think everyone's got a story and everyone's interesting and everyone's got something to offer. And, you know, I love learning, and I learn from everyone. I learn from all my clients. Every client I go to, I learn. Every trainer I interact with, I pick up something from. But I tend not to transfer that to myself, you know. So I should actually think, here you go, you're helping me here, Ryan. I shouldn't think I'm boring. Maybe if someone's listening, they'll pick up one thing. If they pick up one thing that I've said that they go, wow, that's going to help me, then that is worthwhile of sharing. You know, so get over the fear of being boring. Get over the fear of maybe not knowing enough, because someone might learn something, you know, worthwhile from you.
I feel similar things as well. I get invited to talk and partake in 2020 online conferences, and I look at everyone else and go, oh, my God, look who is speaking in the same venue as I. Bravely sharing that, I feel that those same thoughts. So thank you for additionally having courage and saying that to everyone on this podcast, because I dare to think that there are people listening who additionally feel similar things, if not
yeah.
Everyone, maybe. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think we're probably all human. We're probably...
Are you not human, listener of this show? I'm my first alien client yesterday.
Yeah. You know, it's part of the human condition, you know, the imposter syndrome and just comparing. And so when you look at it like that, then yeah.
So if I'm sitting in Quebec, Canada, and I want a dog trainer and I want to get Sonia's expertise on some of my training, where can I go online to find you? And
My website, which is dogcharming.com.au. And you can follow me on Facebook, which again is Dog Charming. So I put videos out there as well. And slowly but surely I'm getting a nice compilation, again, of my warts and all kind of training, like look at me stuff up and look how I fix it kind of training sometimes. And on YouTube you can check out my channel, which is Zurison, named after my dog Willow. My dog Zuri, and my name, so Zurison. I've got lots of videos there that can get you started. And it's a good way of, you know, and then if you like that style of training, you can go, wow, I'd like a one-on-one on video consult.
And we will, of course, link to all of that in the show notes for this episode as well. Well, as often happens in 2020, after doing these podcasts for 4 years, I'm looking at the clock and seeing that we've been going for an hour. And Sonia and I had a really meaningful, emotional topic that's going to resonate a lot with our audience that we wanted to talk about today. But we just jumped off the recording for a little bit and decided that instead of trying to rush through it, because then we're not really delivering you, the audience, the value that we think we can and we would like to, we're going to invite Sonia back for part two of I'm saying Sonia's name wrong. Remind me,
it's a Y, Sonia. So it's Sonia.
I've got to put on an Australian accent. Sonia. I said to Sonia when we pushed recording, I said, you're not from Scandinavia, so your name's easy, but shows me I'll never say that again to a guest. We're going to turn this episode with Sonia back into two parts, and we're going to talk about Sonia's experiences in helping a learner go through the process of becoming an amputee. One of her dogs I'm talking about. We're going to be talking about that in part two and what that taught Sonia about life, about training and about husbandry. So that is what you had to look forward to. But for today, Sonia, we just want to express our gratitude for your life's work and everything that you've done and your why, which I believe I'm going to make up, but I believe I can do that. And it resonates very strongly with ATAs, which is to help animals and their humans, plain and simple. It resonates with ours. So we're grateful for everything you do and for taking time to hang out with us today. Thank you so much.
And thank you. Thank you for this great opportunity. I really appreciate it.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much everyone for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.